We're about to have a conversation with Tom Schaller, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, of course, and writes political columns. The Baltimore Sun is known throughout the country and has done stuff on major national TV. The last book, Whistling Past Dixie, and of course he joined us several years back. God, it was almost 8 years back at the DNC in 2008 when Obama was first elected. Good to see you, Tom.
Great to be back, Mark.
I forgot that we did that back then. We had that debate with you and
Bob Mosier.
Yes.
Yeah.
We wrote Past Dixie, or
wrote a book called Blue Dixie, which is sort of a response to my book.
Right, exactly.
Don't give up on the South. Which it's not going well for the Democrats there. But
it's not, is it? I mean, not at all.
That's the last book, though.
But
it's still holding up, I think.
But it's connected.
It is connected
to this book.
A little bit, yeah.
You know, I think it is connected to this.
They're different arguments, though. That book was a partisan regional argument. And what I like to say about this book is it's an ideological institutional argument. It's about which party is better situated, arguably, for the House and Senate or the presidency. And so you could say they're companion books, but they come at it from a different approach.
I guess we should say we're talking about the book The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress But Surrendered the White House, which is the book we're talking about.
Thanks. Always get the title.
You want to get the name out there, right?
Yeah, that helps.
Let's begin with this. I mean, it's really, people argue about why this takes place and why the Republicans have this power at the moment. One of the things you always seem to argue in here that it's inflated representation, but real.
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans are a better Congress party now than they used to be, and a weaker presidential party in the last 20 years. And part of the reason I'm trying to argue or explain in the book for their congressional success is they have some structural advantages, which we could talk about. Gerrymandering, they dominate small state elections, which is what you're talking about. And I also think they have this sort of governmental disposition advantage, which is they're the party that wants the government to national government to do less. They want more power to the states. They want to slow and thwart and dilute and retrench or even repeal parts of the government. And it makes more sense to do that from the Congress. So let me unpack those two. And they're complementary. Let me unpack them. The first is that the Republicans have been a very strong congressional party over the last 10 Congresses, the last 20 years since Gingrich and the Republican Revolution, which just celebrated its 20th anniversary. Something almost nobody noticed or mentioned at the installation of this new Congress, I noticed. Like, it's almost as if the party doesn't even recognize or want to remember that. Do you remember anybody talking about Gingrich and this is the 20-year anniversary?
That's when we started the show 20 years ago. Gingrich was just taking power.
Yeah, in 1995. And
right.
So this new Congress, and they just captured the Senate and so forth, and there was very little mention of Gingrich, you know. And he's still alive. He just ran for president last cycle. Anyway, so the Republicans have done really well in Congress, and one of the reasons is they do have somewhat inflated control of Congress relative to, say, some sort of benchmark of support. We know that in 2012, though not in 2014, the total number of votes cast for all the House candidates in the 435 House districts was more than Boehner and the Republicans in their 435 House seats received, but Boehner had a larger majority. And in fact, in that election, Obama carried fewer House districts than Mitt Romney did, even though Obama won the election. And that's because Democrats are, and through no fault of the Republicans, tend to be artifactually packed into dense suburban and urban areas.
We unpack this.
Sure.
Let me stop the unpacking as we go.
Okay.
I won't leave any socks on the floor here.
Sure. All right. We got time.
Bad pun. I take that away. So let me just understand from your perspective, your argument, what that means. I mean, if the Democrats won more votes in this country for Congress.
That's right.
In total, right?
Yep.
But they're in a huge minority inside the U.S. Congress.
That's right.
House of Representatives. And Obama won but lost the majority of votes.
Captured a few House districts.
Yeah.
His votes.
Right. In congressional districts and lost. So how is that possible? What does that mean?
Let's start there.
This only
affects the House. And let me start with the first factual, counterfactual, but very interesting little factoid. There are two states, as you may know, that do not assign their electoral votes like the other 48 states, including Maryland, do as a winner-take-all basis. There's Maine and Nebraska.
Right.
And if you remember back in 2008, Obama carried the Omaha-based, which has the University of Nebraska. It's obviously a little bit more liberal than
right.
the rest of the state. He carried Nebraska's first district. And because Nebraska and Maine, and they're the only two states, they start from the premise that, hey, your number of electoral votes is equal to the number of House districts you have and the number of senators you have, which every state has two. So we should assign our two electors based on who wins statewide, because senators are elected statewide, and we'll assign one elector each for whichever presidential candidate wins the plurality in each of the respective districts.
So it's not divided up between if you win 52% and the Republicans win 48%.
It's not proportional.
It's not proportional.
There was a movement for a while in Colorado to move Colorado's assignment to proportional. And the states, of course, under federalism, have the authority to do this however they want. If you go back to the elections in the early 1800s, there were four or five different methods for how states assign their electoral votes. Now, it's pretty universal with the exception of those two states. So what would have happened if we'd taken the votes for Obama and Romney in 2012 in the other 48 states and applied the same Maine-Nebraska model where you get two electoral votes if you win the state, statewide total popular votes, and then you win the electoral vote one at a time for each of the other districts, the 435 House districts, and then, of course, three for D.C. Well, we know Obama carried 207 House districts, which is a minority, right? 217, 218 is half. He carried 24 states, two fewer than he did in 2008. He lost North Carolina back, but he carried the other 24, exact subset, right? So 24 times 2, that's 48. You add 48 to 207, you're at 255. And he carried the District of Columbia easily, three electoral votes, 258 electoral votes. He's 12 shy. So if the other 48 states use the Maine and Nebraska model, Obama loses re-election even though he won the popular vote by 3.5 points nationally. And interestingly enough, if you say, well, that's just a quirky little thing that some college professor talks about because he teaches the American presidency and presidential elections, which I do. But do you realize that several states, including Ohio and Pennsylvania and Virginia and I believe Michigan, began to investigate Republicans in those states moving to the Maine and Nebraska model? And Rents Priebus, the Republican national chair, said maybe this is something that we should look at. Now, Republicans in most of those states in the end said this is a crazy idea. We shouldn't start tinkering with the rules just because we lost this election. But they're aware of it, and they're understanding that they have a Congress majority in a way that they can't build a presidential majority because the other 48 states have winner-take-all assignment. So This very much speaks to the issue. Obama represents a minority of the House districts in the country. He does, if you think of it from whoever won them.
And is that because the majority of the states have majority Republican legislatures and governors?
No, it's because the majority – well, yes, indirectly, but because the districts are drawn in such a way that they favor the Republicans. This is why in 2012, the 435 Democratic candidates who ran for House got more votes in the presidential 2012 cycle than the 435 House Republicans, 1.5 million more votes, and yet Boehner retained his majority. Why? Because Democratic voters are inefficiently distributed. And why is that? Because the Republicans dominated the 2010 cycle, the Tea Party cycle, in governors and state legislative races, and of course they drew the districts in a way that's much more favorable to House candidates.
Now, I'm going to finish unpacking, but some of it is counterintuitive to people listening to this, I think, in some ways. I mean, so if Democrats have the majority of the vote in a national election, then why are they losing so much in the states across the country?
Well, some of it is just because the Republicans are doing better. Let's be clear about that. The Republicans have 32 of the governors right now. They have about 2/3 of the state legislators and 2/3 of the legislative chambers across the country. They're doing pretty well in subnational elections. But some of it has to do, particularly in the House, with gerrymandering. And again, as I pointed out earlier, some of the Republican advantage in gerrymandering has nothing to do with anything the Republicans have done strategically or if you think they're bad in a mendacious way. It's just the fact that Democrats are just artifactually and very densely packed in urban and inner suburban areas. It makes it easier to create a district that's 80% African-American and therefore about 80% Democratic. And so that's inefficient because what you really want to do is create a bunch of districts that you have 55, 60, 65% of your party, not 80 or 90% because then it becomes inefficient. And in fact, as I talked about in the book, as you know, it was the Republicans who colluded with the Congressional Black Caucus way back in 1990, the 1990
boundary edition, right.
And said, let us give you our fancy software and let us help you create majority-minority districts because they knew that would allow them to create more Republican districts outside of the urban areas. And that's exactly what happened. The minority population in the country, as I point out in the book, Mark, grew 17% between 1980 and the 1990 census. But the number of minority members of the U.S. House of Representatives grew by 107%. It was the largest freshman class of black legislators in 1992, right after the census, in American history before that or since. And the Republicans helped make that possible, and it worked to their advantage because they created
They wanted to see more black representation because they wanted to control the House.
Well, both, actually, because what it did was it racialized the Democratic caucus. I mean, there are only 6 white Democrats in the House of Representatives from the South right now. There are almost no minority and there are almost no white Democrats in the South. So if you're a Southerner and race matters at all to you and you look and say, who are statewide officials and public leaders, even state legislators? Most of them are non-white. And so the Republicans, it had a double effect. One is it created more Republican districts inside the South and out. And the remaining, the residual Democratic districts, fewer in number, were more racialized. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, still to this day. I think this happened first in 2012. Do you know that she's the first chamber leader of either party in either chamber in American history to lead a caucus that's not majority white male? 53 or 54% of her members are either non-white, male or female, okay, or they're minority men. Every other caucus in American history, either party, either chamber, has been led by a majority of white men. In fact, the Republicans in the House are 90% white men.
Right.
Right. So this is the nature of the demography of the country and the connections between people of different race, white, black, Latino, to the respective parties, but also has to do very much with how those people are drawn into districts. I mean, our gerrymandering, and both parties do it, and I've written this in the Sun, as you know. Democrats very shrewdly have gerrymandered this state in an overwhelming way that's disfavorable to the Republicans, right, and you could argue is unfair.
Because
it's certainly
the third,
unequal.
The third, the fourth, and is it the eighth? Delaney's
right.
district?
Sure. I mean, that's, right. They created right. Delaney's district, right. and they created a district for Ruppersberger, you know, a decade before that.
Right.
So both parties do it, and it's a problem. I mean, we have a system where the politicians pick the voters, mm-hmm. and the voters don't pick the politicians.
So let's go back, finish unpacking.
Okay.
That's
just the House side. We can get to the Senate now.
Right. So I just wanted to kind of walk through some issues, unpack, to kind of understand what the unpacking means.
Okay. Well, on the Senate side, the Republicans, as I show in the book in a little chart in Chapter 6, the Republicans, whether they're in the majority or the minority, they're overrepresented in the Senate and have been for 30 or 40 years now. So, you know, they might have 55 senators, which was their high point under Trent Lott, for example. But if you add up the people in the states that those senators represent, it might only be 50 or 49% of the states, of the national population. Why? They have two from Wyoming and, you know, usually two from Alaska and two from Idaho. Now, there are some small state Democrats over the years in places like North Dakota and certainly places like Vermont and Rhode Island. But when you add it all up, the fact that frankly, it just comes down to two states. The fact that Democrats over the last 20 years, 30 years, have had, for the most part, after Al D'Amato got beat by Chuck Schumer, they've had the two senators from New York and the two senators from California, and those two states alone just sort of tipped the scale. Whereas, you know, the other states right now, Florida's split between one Democrat and Republican, so that neutralizes it. And so the Republicans are overrepresented in the Senate, and they're overrepresented in the House thanks to gerrymandering, which is partially strategically their decision and partially no fault of their own, as I pointed out. And that's good for them. That's not a bad thing, and you can't really blame them for taking advantage of the rules as they're written, right? The problem, as I argue in the book, is it's easy to walk around and say, well, geez, we're winning. We got two majorities here. We must be – what we're saying must be right. What we're saying must be tapping into what the national population wants, what the public will is. And that may be kind of receiving a false message. You know, if every time you knew you were a kid, you were lined up against the wall with your brothers and sisters and your parents were, you know, doing the little check marks against the edge of the, you know, but they allowed you to stand on the phone book, you'd say, boy, I'm 6'2". And then you go to class and you think, boy, I don't feel as tall on the basketball team tryouts than I do. It says at home I'm 5'2", but really I'm only 4'8". So you're getting a false message there because you have a little bit of population a political inflation by virtue. And again, not always the Republicans' fault, by the way we elect Senate. And by the gerrymandering effect in the House. And so this has helped make them a strong Congress party. And I don't see any way the Democrats recapture their House majority.
Ever.
Until at least 2022 after the next census and the next redistricting. And by the way, and I mentioned this in the book as well, in 2010, the Republicans in 2009, 2010, they created this program called Red Map. And it's basically was a program to try to elect Republicans to governor and state legislature so they could control the state houses, which draw the maps, right? Because it's state governments that draw their own state house districts for House and Senate, right? But they also draw the U.S. House districts. And who was put in charge? Who was the person that was in charge of the Republican Legislative Campaign Committee? It was a guy named Ed Gillespie, no stranger to national politics. This guy used to be not only the Virginia State Party chair, the Republican National Party chair. This was the guy who walks around when Bush appointed his Alito and so forth to bench. This is a guy who took, you know, as a consigliere, takes Supreme Court appointments, a top-level national political figure who ran for Senate, as you know. Why is he down in the trenches running state legislative races, the former party chair? That'd be like a former president running for his old Maryland General Assembly district. Doesn't make any sense. And it does when you think about it. The Republicans were paying attention in 2010, and the Democrats got caught sleeping. And they've already announced that they have a plan for 2020 already. It's only 2015, Mark, because they're not going to get caught around the census and the districting again next time because they were asleep at the switch in 2010.
I was reading this book, this is what the questions I want to ask before we get back into the heart of what you're saying here, because there's so much in here that's fascinating. When I get into the 1990s, which you spend a lot of time on in the book.
Yeah, the early 90s, yeah.
I mean, what that meant for this transformation. But talking about 2010 just for a minute and what happened there. So, I mean, you lay it out in a very succinct and kind of clear for want of a better term, scientific manner. It's just how this happened. But how much of it also was A, bad strategy on Democrats, but B, some political decisions? I mean, I've heard some people argue that part of the reason, and I've made this argument, and you may disagree with it completely, that one of the reasons that Democrats lost the House, lost the legislature and Congress in 2010, was because of, in some ways, the timidity of Barack Obama not taking on things that people thought he was going to take on, because the way he was elected with all this kind of hope and glamour and hope and ideas of where the country should go, and the numbers of African Americans, Latinos, and young people were up in terms of the election, and got really disappointed when the banks weren't taken on, where other things happened, and thought that he was not being forceful enough, and you saw the demographics where the people began backing away in 2010 from the election, just like that happened here in Maryland in this last election. Fewer Democrats came out, and that might have been part of the equation that allowed the Republicans to take the House.
I mean, I think that's certainly true. And, you know, where my politics are, most of my criticisms of Obama are from his left, you know, which when you talk to a conservative and you say Obama's been a pragmatic centrist, they're like, what are you talking about? He's a socialist communist, right? So it just shows you the partisan divisions of the country. I often say I'm amazed that Obama's not the most popular president ever right now, because people on the left think he's too far to the center, and Republicans think he's too, you know, too far to the left. So that should mean every independent in the country should be loving Barack Obama. Why don't they? And in some senses, he's governed very much like Clinton. I think he's, you know, Bill Clinton, that is.
Yeah,
I think
right,
he's
right.
Governed a little bit to the left of Clinton. You know, in 2009, 2010, Obama had a lot of political capital. He had pretty decent majorities and strong, you know, election tailwind. And I think he just decided, against the advice of people like Rahm Emanuel, who said do energy first, you know, he decided to spend it on health care. And there's two ways to look at that. Like, boy, that's bad. That wasn't good for the party. You're going to lose House seats and maybe the Senate seats in one chamber. And he did, of course, or both chambers. And he did, of course, lose to the House but not the Senate in 2010. The other way to look at it is the Bush philosophy, which was, and this is what Bush said in his second term, George W. Bush, what's the point of having political capital if you don't spend it? I mean, Clinton left with a 62% approval margin. But at the end of his presidency, he was doing school lunches and school uniforms. I mean, is that major national reform? No. Obama did something that no president had done in 60 years. And you can say it cost his party some brand damage and one chamber in 2010 and maybe eventually the other chamber in 2014. But he did it. And you can say, well, maybe the law's got some problems the way he implemented it and so forth. But, you know, there's two ways of looking at Barack Obama in that sense. But with respect to the book and this sort of tension between the two branches and the two parties in the two branches, you have to remember two things. With midterm elections, there's sort of two philosophies about how midterm elections operate among political scientists and electoral analysts and people like me. The one is what's called surge and decline, which means – and this is much more contemporary or modern phenomena, and it's because of the racial and dynamics and demographic changes in the country. And this says that in presidential elections, we have a higher turnout. We know that. That's not in dispute. But that turnout, that higher turnout electorate, is fundamentally different in terms of the composition. It tends to be more non-whites, younger, less affluent, more unmarrieds and so forth, more millennials and sort of the emerging electorate types. And then in midterm elections, it drops back down again, and it's a more affluent, older, white, male, married, and so forth electorate, more religious electorate in midterm elections when we get 34% of the eligible electorate, and then the presidential election, 55-60. And that difference and the demographic – in other words, one is not a pure subset of the other – hurts the Democrats, and I think there's some truth to that. The other argument is what's called the referendum theory of midterm elections, which is that the midterm electorate, okay, it's not identical to the presidential electorate, but it basically is a reasonable proxy for it. It's fewer voters, but they, for the most part, represent the broader electorate. And what they do is they send a referendum to national politics, and that referendum is usually negative against whoever is in the White House, that party. Now, think about those two phenomena for a moment. If you're a Democrat in the White House, the referendum phenomenon, if you assume it's a negative referendum, right? Because remember, Clinton in 1998 was the first incumbent president who picked up House seats in a midterm election since 1934. So it's clear the referendum phenomenon has been going on since the New Deal. All right. So Obama gets into office. You got a Democrat in office. So his party should suffer from the referendum phenomenon. If he's not doing a perfect job, he's going to lose some seats, maybe even a chamber in 2010, which is exactly what happened. But Democrats also suffer from surge and decline because the electorate is less white, less, you know, is younger and so forth, right? And more affluent, excuse me, older, and it's more white, excuse me, I said it backwards. So the surge in decline phenomena hurts Democrats in midterms, and referendum hurts Democrats when they're in the White House in referendum. They work in concert. They work together. They compound each other. When Republicans are in the White House, like Bush in 2006, he gets damaged by referendum, but he gets compensated a little bit by the fact that people, you know, non-white people, younger people, students, poor people, unmarried people turn out at lower rates. So for the Republicans, this is, again, another structural advantage they have. Referendum and surge and decline work against each other. They neutralize a little bit for a Republican president. But when the Democrats in the White House, they work in concert with each other. They're moving in the same direction. So this is a structural disadvantage that Democrats have. And this is why you hear Obama saying, he just said 2 weeks ago, Mark, if all the people who turned out in the presidential election had turned out in 2014, we wouldn't have lost the Senate. And he's right. And so he's like, you got to tell people. He went to Selma and said that, right? Actually, he said, we got to get these people who – we got to figure out a way to get these people who only show up every 4 years to start showing up every 2 years. And that is a fundamental and perhaps intractable problem, and I don't know how the Democrats are going to solve that problem.
So I want to come back to some of that because I really want to ask a question about – kind of probe your thinking on the attacks on Obama. I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. But I want to talk a bit about the 1990s because you spend a lot of time in this book. In that decade, in that political decade, and why that was so significant in changing in the change that happened in America.
Well, I think it's with the benefit of retrospect. I don't think we knew it at the time. As I argue in the book, this is sort of the literally the pivotal period, the period when the two parties like ships in the night pass each other. You have a Democratic Party that had dominated Congress for 40 consecutive years from 1954 to 1994. They controlled the House the entire 40 years, and they controlled the Senate all but Reagan's first 6 years, so 34 of those 40 years. And in 1992, Clinton comes into office following 7 out of 10 presidential losses by the Democrats. So the Republicans had been the presidential dominant party until 92, and then suddenly, we couldn't know this until now, the Democrats reel off 4 of the next 6 wins and 5 of the 6 in the popular vote because of Gore's victory over Bush in the popular vote in 2000. So somehow the party that lost 7 out of 10 somehow wins 5 of the next 6 in the popular vote, the Democrats. And then somehow just 2 years later, between 1992 and 94 revolution in Gingrich, the Republicans go from a party that had been completely whitewashed out of Congress for 40 years, and they dominate Congress so far, at least for the next 20 years, and may dominate for the next 20 going forward. So all of this happened in a very short period of time in the late 80s and early 90s at the end of sort of Bush 41's lone term. And so I spent an inordinate amount of time looking at the Bush presidency and the early Clinton presidency era and what happened with the
first
two parties.
Bush.
The first Bush, yeah.
Bush, yeah.
And the first Clinton.
Right.
Maybe. and that's really the pivot. And what happened then? And there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. And, we could get into episodes if you want. I looked at two Republicans in particular in the book. One is Mickey Edwards, who just emailed me
right.
A couple weeks ago. Actually, we both have books from Yale. So we're fellow Yale authors. And the other is Dick Armey. And there's two episodes in there. There's lots of other episodes. And there's episodes I probably left out or didn't think of. But I focus on Edwards and Armey because they did something sort of remarkable. Armey wrote an op-ed in the New York Times criticizing Bush on the No New Taxes pledge. And, that's
right.
The kind of thing that, to criticize your president. He's a, House member from Texas. And he's only in his third or fourth term at that time. He's not Dick Armey, the leader, yet. To go out on a limb like that, in some senses, is kind of the behavior that we're now seeing from that Tea Party wing of the party that's very vociferous and critical of its own party and doesn't care if there's party consequences of it. The other episode I talk about is how Mickey Edwards lost his renomination in the 1992 Republican primary in Oklahoma in what turned out to be a 5-way race that he finished I think third, and Jim Istook finished second, and there was a runoff, and Istook won the runoff for the nomination, then won Mickey Edwards' seat. And I don't do it in the book, but in some senses, I now refer to Mickey Edwards as the first Tea Party casualty, the first Republican taken down from within his own party. And so, some of the things that we see today, 20 years later, that have reached more fruition and they're more fully formed movements, I think if you go back and look, you see the sort of early waves of this 20 years ago.
I'm going to kind of probe that a bit more because in this, you talk about Jeffords in this book.
Mm-hmm.
As well, this kind of shift that was taking place in the 90s among the Republicans,
right.
And what happened almost as if this was the roots of the Tea Party's explosion.
That's right.
We're in the 90s here. And people didn't know that. They weren't seeing that.
I think so, yes.
So we're going to take a very brief break and come right back and continue this conversation. We're talking with Tom Schaller, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMBC, been a frequent guest on the show over the years. His book before was Whistling Past Dixie. The latest book we're talking about right now is The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House. On our way to break, it's One Toke Over the Line by Brewer and Shipley. This day in 1971, Brewer and Shipley entered the pop charts with this song, despite being banned by radio for its reference to marijuana. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to Mark Steiner Show right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. That's December 1963, Oh What a Night by the Four Seasons. They started a three-week run at number one with this song on this day in 1976. We're here with Tom Schaller, associate professor of political science at UMBC, about his latest book, The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress But Surrendered the White House. When we left off, we were talking about the 90s, because you spent, as you said, an inordinate amount of time, but you spent, I think, an important amount of time on the 90s and why they've changed politics in America. And I said something about that they, even though Gingrich and Dick Armey and clearly Dole and the others were not Tea Partiers in a classic sense of what we think of Tea Partiers in the 21st century. There was something in that revolution that was the revolution we're in now.
Yeah, and I think you see the early wave of it where, first of all, it's coming from the Congress. There's a sort of a pushback against their own incumbent president, and they weaken Bush in a way that he gets, you know, challenged in the primary in 92, and they lose the White House. And they're not necessarily upset that they lost the White House. I mean, that's a crazy thing, right, to think about, that the House Republicans, then still in the minority, were perfectly happy to lose control of the entire national government. But in some senses, it put them in a position to therefore capture the Congress just 2 years later in 1994. And what we know, by the way, is that American government, American citizens really like divided government. And I looked at the polls of this in either Chapter 6 or Chapter 7 of the book. And what we see is a very consistent pattern. Whichever parties in the White House, the self-identified partisans of that party, so Democrats right now, they by about a 2-to-1 margin will say they like unified government, implying that, you know, the president has the Congress too. The out party will say by a 2-to-1 margin they want divided government, but independents side with the out party. So in 2006, when Bush was coming up for his second midterm and the Iraq war and all that other stuff, they asked this question: do you prefer divided government or unified government? Republicans 2-to-1 said unified government. Democrats said 2-to-1 divided government, and independents sided with the Democrats, and Bush lost both chambers. Fast forward to 2010, same question, identical question asked by Gallup: do you prefer divided government or unified government? Now, Democrats, by a 2-to-1 margin, they've completely changed. I mean, this is so partisan of them, right? They've completely changed their attitude. Self-identified Democrats, we want unified government. They don't want Obama to lose the Congress. Republicans, the out party, saying 2-to-1, we want divided government. And independents stay the same. Now they're on the side of the Republicans, and Obama loses the House and seats in the Senate. That said, by 1994, you've got a unified Democratic White House, and maybe Clinton overreaches. Maybe Hillary Clinton's health care task force gives the Republicans a big, giant bouquet, you know, that they can exploit. Maybe Clinton made some missteps, of course, with his early chiefs of staff and the Lonnie Guinier episode, things that I talk about in there.
Right.
That gets the Republicans in a position where they can now make an argument, referendum theory of presidential congressional elections, midterm cycle, to send a message to Washington that they don't like what Clinton and the Democrats are doing, and the public does send them that message in, again, a very low turnout election, an extraordinarily low turnout election. In fact, in another piece, which I reference in there, that I wrote for Larry Sabato down at University of Virginia, the biggest drop-off in turnout between a presidential election and the succeeding midterm cycle in the last 40 years, the two biggest ones were between 92 and 94, when the Republicans picked up the Congress, both chambers, and between 2008, Obama's wave election, and 2010, when the Republicans picked up the House. So they really benefit when people get turned off by politics. There's a low turnout. It's affluent and more white and more older, and they can win.
Well, let me. This was not necessarily in the book, but there was kind of some little subtext pieces were throughout this that made me think of this. Is there a subjective difference in this objective analysis that things have changed in the last 50 years in America in terms of voting and who's participating in politics,
mm-hmm.
so that you had mostly white middle class, working class people who were voting in American politics.
That's right, up through the 70s and 80s.
Right, and then with Clinton and that period when Clinton was elected president, Clinton's not black, clearly, but people used to make these kind of quips about Clinton being the first black president.
Right. Toni Morrison. Right.
Because he's, you know, and a lot of African Americans and other minorities and women came out to vote for Clinton.
Right.
And now you see this real shift. So these parties are split very much, as you described Nancy Pelosi's House of Representatives.
Right.
These parties really split along those demographic lines. They're split between white, the old white middle class voters and white voters and new African-American, Latino voters and more women coming out, younger women. And there's a real split. And that has something to do with this battle for control and how that you describe how the demographics are of people not coming in during the midterm elections on the Democratic side, that's part of what is being played out here. I mean, that Clinton was seen as a president that represented African Americans, and a lot of Republicans did not like that. I mean, they are the Dixiecrats of the past.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
The only northern states like Wisconsin that are in the Republican world was the same state where George Wallace won a plurality of the votes
right.
when he ran.
Sure.
Right? From Alabama. So I'm saying that's a play in this too, is it not?
Well, a lot of it has to do with race, and certainly a lot of it, you know, race is also related to region, and I write about this in the last book, Whistling Past Dixie. I mean, the great little sort of factoid here is that when Ronald Reagan won re-election, he got 71% of the white vote. He won 49 states and demolished Mondale 60-40. He won by 20 points nationally,
right.
Carried every state except for one, along with Roosevelt's 36 re-election, the largest, and Nixon's 72 re-election, the largest electoral landslide since Washington won all the electoral votes when there was no voting, popular voting.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You know, because
right.
that was all by elite centers.
Right, right.
But since there was voting to determine the electoral college, the three biggest victories are Roosevelt's 36 and Nixon in 72 and Reagan. Okay, so Reagan gets 70% of the white vote and wins a landslide in 84. Fast forward 20 years, George Bush is running for election. He gets 1 point less. He gets 70% to Reagan's 71% of the white vote, and he squeaks by in re-election, wins by 2.5 points, carries, I think, 30 states, and, you know, beats Kerry a little bit comfortably, but no landslide, right? And wins like 30 states to Kerry's 20. Well, that tells you right there, if 70% of the white vote in 1984 gets you a national landslide and 70% of the white vote 2004, just 20 years later, gets you a relatively narrow election that without Ohio, Bush could have lost that election, won the popular vote like he beat Gore and gone out the same
right.
way he come in, right? And that tells you about the rising, you know, non-white voter share, which is going to keep rising as the Latino vote continues to rise. So in the last election, you know, the electorate's about, you know, 13% African-American and it's 10% Latino. And Asian-Americans actually now outnumber Latinos in legal immigrants this country. As of the 2013 census, most people don't know that. Latinos were the number one immigrant group for 33 years until 2013. Now, Asian Americans, broadly defined, that's a lot of different subgroups.
Yeah, it's
Indian,
it's
Vietnamese.
Indians, Vietnamese, Chinese, right? Japanese, right, right.
And they all vote, overwhelming majority is Democratic. You know, Latino voters and Asian American voters voted the exact same rate in 2012, 72% for Obama. And, of course, African Americans voted 94-95% for Obama. It wasn't always that way, though, right? Republicans used to be much more competitive among the Latino vote. And actually, George W. H.W. Bush in 1988 and even against Clinton in 1992 carried the Asian American vote. So the country is definitely polarizing on race between the sort of Democratic, you know, polyglot and the Republican white, largely white coalition. And there are Republicans that are aware of this and sensitive to it and trying to do something about it, including Jeb Bush, among others, because they can only squeeze out as many majorities in the Senate and the House and in the presidency from their declining white, male, older, religious, evangelical, affluent base. At some point, the tide of history will overwhelm them, and they're aware of that. And a big part of my book is arguing, does the Republican Party want to affect a broad recovery, or is it going to try to figure out ways like moving to the Maine-Nebraska model to manipulate the
right.
way their votes are aggregated so they can just keep winning elections even though they have a declining voting?
Because you
support.
Mentioned and talk about in the beginning of the book and the end of the book about the how can I get the right? No, you'll know what I mean as soon as I say it. The,
sure.
the GOP study, the
Governing Opportunity Project.
The Governing Opportunity Project.
They published it right after the election and
right.
after they lost to Romney because they thought they were going to beat Obama. And so Rents Priebus, the RNC chair, commissioned this report to be studied. And it was like an after-action internal report. And they interviewed like 1,100 people from, you know, state politicians and national politicians and their consultants and their pollsters and their donors and think tanks and everybody. They took a broad brush of people from, you know, across the country, men and women, old and young, and said, you know, we're interviewing all these people. What's wrong with the party? and their conclusions. These aren't my conclusions, even though I sort of affirm them in the concluding chapter of this book, is this is a party, number one, that has a federal wing problem. And in 2013, what does that mean? That means the Congress. There is no Republican president. There still isn't, right? We have a federal wing. It was a polite way of saying our Congress is a problem. That's their own conclusion. I didn't write that. They wrote that, right? And we should turn to our governors and state officials for new ideas and energy and input. I agree. I think that's right. And they're doing really well in the state level. And I think maybe it'll be Scott Walker will be their nominee or a former governor.
We're sitting in the state right now that has a Republican governor that didn't.
Right?
People, yeah.
Right. Or Chris Christie. Right? Right. I mean, I think they should nominate a governor. In fact, I have a quote in the end of the book from Kevin McCarthy from the House Republican saying, I don't think we should ever nominate anybody who hasn't served as governor. Maybe they could be a senator now, but they had to have managed a government before they're going to manage the federal government. It's hard to make the critique. And you hear this all the time on conservative talk radio. Obama's never run anything. He was a first term senator. I got it so much pushback from my column saying Ben Carson is not prepared to be president of the United States. And they're like, Obama's a community organizer. And I'm like, well, first of all, that wasn't his last job. That's like saying I'm not prepared to be president because I was a paper boy. I mean, I did other things since then. So even though I think Obama's better qualified than Ben Carson, there is this argument that, hey, he never ran a government, right? The biggest thing he ever ran was Obama for president in 2008. That's true. And I think Republicans can't make that argument and then go ahead and nominate Rick Santorum or Ted Cruz. And one of the little factoids I have in the book, I opened the book with it, is Mitt Romney got 25% of the Iowa caucus vote. But when you add up the four congressional contenders in the Iowa caucus, Gingrich, Santorum, Paul, and Michelle Bachmann, they got 64% of the vote. Those are four people who've never run a government either, right? Those are four House and Senate members who got 2.5 votes for every vote that the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, got. So I think there's something to this argument, and the Republicans are making this argument. The other thing that they talk about, they talk about a lot of stuff like message and media and stuff.
Right.
The other thing they say is, look, we need to talk to non-white voters. You know, they can do the calculus of the, you know, they can look at the same forecast that you and I look like for the population trends. In 2050 will be, you know, potentially a majority Latino country, right? So they know that they're a party that can only go so far down this route. And they say very clearly in the document, we need to get to figure out comprehensive immigration reform, because unless you do that, Latinos aren't going to listen to any of our messages on economic vitality and all this other stuff and religious messages. And they're willing to listen to us, but they don't trust us if we don't have a reasonable solution on immigration. That's a sine qua non for them. And yet, look what happened, right? All these Republican candidates, including Ben Carson, trooped down to Steve King in the first week of January to kiss the ring of the most anti-immigrant politician, arguably, in the country and certainly in the U.S. House, Steve King. Now, Jeb Bush didn't go, and Marco Rubio didn't go, given their immigration position. Rubio was one of the gang of eight senators trying to find the compromise,
right?
But everybody else was down there, including Scott Walker, kissing Steve King's ring, which is, you know, when I finished this book, a year ago, January of 2014. The book came out in January 2015. And if you had asked me a year before when I was finishing writing it, what would be a perfect event to encapsulate your book, Tom? I would say one House member, because I talk a lot about how they're a very House strong party, not just a Congress strong party, but anchored in the House, a House dominant party. One House member calling the tune for 8 or 10 presidential candidates, and that's exactly what happened when Steve King said, "I'm having a summit, and if you don't come down here, you know the rabid right Tea Party wing of the party is going to notice that you didn't show up to see if you can outshout the previous speaker about how much you hate." You know, Latinos.
So, I mean, you write in the book, when you talk about this, I do, and then come right back to the 1990s. So we haven't finished the 1990s and all the kind of characters who pull out and what happened to Jeffords and the rest, I think, which is critical to where things are going. And maybe this will bring it out. But you talk about the split between the Baker Dole and Lott Frist world of Congress, right?
Yeah, I mean,
Republicans.
I mean, not only did the Republicans become more of a congressional party in this period in the early 90s, they wanted to become a more Republican party. And I talk about how Bob Dole, even though Republicans wanted him to win, they had a decision in 1996 of whether they should put resources to protect their congressional majorities or advance Bob Dole's presidential campaign against then incumbent Bill Clinton running for re-election. And it's clear from the quotes I put in the book that they were like, well, we'd like to have it all, but if not, we want to keep our congressional majorities. You know, he's a very colorful and bombastic guy, you know, Grover Norquist, but, you know, he has the quote of the book, arguably, when he says, you know, when the house is on fire, you save the baby, not the Van Gogh, and our baby was the congressional majorities. And this is a guy who's an influential person in their politics. And so I go on to talk about how Dole was triply cursed. One is Gingrich's Medicare gambit failed because Clinton outweighted him brilliantly, and that backfired. And
the closing of the government, you mean?
This is in 1995.
Right.
And Dole had to wear that, right? He had to eat that. And they were literally, the DNC and the Clinton-Gore campaign was calling it the Dole-Gingrich ticket, even though Dole ran, of course, with Jack Kemp. So he had to swallow that. And, of course, Gingrich and he had been longtime nemesis. So here he is having to deal with – he was there for the Medicare solution. He was there back in the Reagan era for the Social Security solution in 83, right? And that's why Gingrich called him the tax collector for the welfare state, which Dole still probably has never forgiven Newt Gingrich for that. So that happened. Then he finds out, as I report in the book, like the RNC basically – you know, they wanted to win the White House, but the Republican National Establishment was putting more resources in protecting their congressional majority. So he finally becomes the presidential nominee after all these attempts. And, you know, he was Ford's running mate, as you know, after he dumped Rockefeller. And he finally gets his moment to be at the top of the ticket, and the party suddenly doesn't value the presidency after they had won right. 7 of 10 until the Clinton era, right? So he's like, geez, you know, he got there just after the barn door shut. And then the last insult upon insults was that he resigned in the Senate, as you remember, to say, like, you know, I'm so serious about this, I'm willing to risk my Senate seat because he wasn't up for reelection. And the guy who takes over is Trent Lott, who comes from the southern, more radical wing. Not the dull moderate Midwest wing. So he was sort of got insult upon injury upon insult upon injury for poor Bob Dole. And he's kind of, you know, I guess you, if you talk to Ted Cruz and people, they'll say that McCain and Romney are moderates like Dole. But in some senses, I think Dole was the last moderate to run.
He and Jeffords were the two dinosaurs for the internal Republican Party.
Yeah, and Jeffords. Yeah, right. And Jeffords, this is a little later, of course. So the next cycle, Bush wins in 2000, and Jeffords, who was close to Bush the father, and who eventually admits he is
senator from Vermont.
Jim Jeffords, who's a moderate Republican. He doesn't switch to the Democrats, but he just declares himself an independent and gives Tom Daschle enough votes to have a majority because it was 50-50 prior to that, and Dick Cheney was the tie-breaking vote. So when Bush came into office in January 2001, we had a split Senate, but the Republicans had the majority thanks to the tie-breaking vote of Cheney. As soon as Jeffords switched, and I think it was April, just 4 months in, the Republicans lose the Senate not because of an election but because of a party switch or a party defection, I guess, because he becomes an independent. So Jeffords is this guy who, you know, basically gums up everything because he's calling for the reestablishment of the old Rockefeller wing of the party. And one of the things I talk about toward the end of the book, as you know, Mark, is when we go back and look at this period in the early 90s and we compare it to today and we look at what the Democrats went through when they were a House-only party for a while there under Tip O'Neill when the Reagan swept in the Senate in the first 6 years from 81 to 87. The Democrats, you know, were down to a House-only party, just where Boehner and the Republicans were these last 4 years. But the big difference is that when Clinton and Gore came in the late 80s and early 90s and they formed the Democratic Leadership Council, and a lot of liberal Democrats today are still unhappy about that, the Elizabeth wing and Howard Dean wing of the party is like, that just corporatized the party. And there's a lot of truth to that. And we were talking about this in the context of Obama and health care and pushing back against Wall Street. There's no question Clinton and Gore revived the Democratic Party by moving it to the right and corporatizing it. But when the Democrats moved to the right, that means they moved to the center. There is no movement today for the Republicans. There are no centrist organizations. There was an organization called the Republican Leadership Council.
Right.
It folded in 2011. And it was nobody – so few people had ever heard of it before it folded anyway that I have a column that I – there was a column by David Frum who said, we need a Republican Leadership Council. He didn't know it still existed. And then there's another organization which Bob Ehrlich was a member of when he was in Congress called – and it may still be – the Republican Main Street Partnership. That still exists, but it's on life support. It's Christine Todd Whitman and Charlie Bass, some moderate Republicans. So there is no moderate challenge in the Republican Party saying, hey, we're getting a little too far out here. The moderate centrist wing of the party right now is basically Jeb Bush. That's it. There's nothing like the Democratic Leadership Council. Maybe he'll save the party from itself. We'll see. I don't know. If the Ted Cruz guys and those people and Rand Paul, I mean, they don't seem ready to turn over the party to Jeb Bush. Their view is they lost those last two presidential elections because the candidate wasn't conservative enough, not because the candidate was too conservative. Ted Cruz said that very clearly in his interview with Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker about 6 months ago. So there is a whole – I mean, you think the Tea Party, all those people are there to rally for Jeb Bush? He got booed at CPAC, right?
Right.
So I don't – you know, they're going to have – if Jeb Bush is the nominee, it'll be fascinating because there will be some kind of – internally combustible challenge coming from within the Republican Party.
So as we look at this, I'm going to try to find these two pieces of this book here. So as you look at this, you've got in one part, when you write in the book that given the malapportionment right. may confer far greater partisan advantage to the small state advantage party. In present, there's no doubt the Republicans are that party. It's truly surprising the Republicans hold the House without the Senate.
That's right.
That's because we wrote the book before they grabbed it all. But then earlier you say, and it's not necessarily a contradiction, but it's an interesting juxtaposition. When you write about the extinction of of Republicans, and you talked about where the Senate was going. I mean, so where do you think it's going? I mean, is it when you make allusions that the Republicans could lose the Senate, but probably not.
Right.
But they're going to control the House from here on in.
Right.
I mean, so.
Well, that's right. That's a fair point. Okay, so the Republicans have a built-in advantage at present in the Senate because they dominate more of the smaller state Senate elections, right? There's Democrats from Vermont and Rhode Island and so forth. That wasn't always the case, by the way, right? So let's just back up. Some party has to get more votes in the Senate than the people that they represent because all the states aren't equally populated. And we know that,
right.
You know, so some states doing better with the big states and some parties doing better with the smaller states at some point in history. And it hasn't always been the Republicans. I went back and looked in the 40s and 50s when Republicans used to be able to elect people from California and Illinois and New York on a regular basis. The Democrats were actually overrepresented in the Senate in the middle part of the century. It wasn't until the late 70s and early 80s when the Republicans started doing really well in these smaller and rural states, okay? So given that they have a built-in advantage from Article 1 of the Constitution, which says, you know, every state gets two senators, whether they have 500,000 people in Wyoming or 30-some-odd million in California, and that's not the Republicans' fault, right, that, you know, even though they might like it. They should, if they only have one chamber, they should, in theory, only have the Senate. So the fact that they only had the House for 4 years was pretty anomalous, right? And in fact, I went back and looked. I went back and researched the Republican Party control of House and Senate to 1854 when the Republican Party was founded, before Lincoln had even been elected. And do you know how many times the Republicans had the House for 4 years without the Senate until John Boehner? Never! Ever! There were only six Congresses in 150 years, six two-year periods where there was a Republican House and no Republican Senate, and it only lasted for 2 years. And so that's why I said John Boehner is arguably the most powerful House Republican, not House Speaker, House Republican Speaker in party history, because he was running their only chamber and that they controlled and had it for 4 years. And so now they have the Senate back, and the balance is a little bit more equal between the two chambers. But they may lose it back in 2016. It's a presidential cycle, which is a little better for Democrats.
Talking about the Senate.
The Senate. And unlike this past cycle where the Republicans, the Democrats were defending like 23 of the 33 seats, I think the Republicans are defending 21 or 22. So they have that big Tea Party class from 2010 up for reelection that they have to defend. The Democrats are only defending like 10 or 11 seats. So they had a huge advantage just because of the cycling in 2014, where the Democrats had their huge class from 2006, the Bush pushback, the Ben Cardin class, right, had to come up for re-election in 2012. And then the Obama class in 2008 was up in 2014. So the Democrats had two big classes to defend the last two cycles, and the Republicans came close in 2012 and then finally went over the top in 2014. But now you have the first big Republican wave class, the 2010 class is up in 2016, and it's a presidential cycle.
And you said that you thought that the Republicans could maintain control of the House for the next 20 years.
Until 2022. Yeah, because you're going to need another redistricting and another gerrymandering cycle to do that. I don't see any way that, you know, barring like, I mean, I suppose if a Republican president got into office in 2016 and destroyed the economy or something, maybe. But I think the Democrats need another census/gerrymandering redistricting cycle to be able to put the districts in position for them to win it. So I think the Republicans will be in the House till at least 2022, but not necessarily in the Senate. They could lose it back as quickly as 2016.
Is there a visceral part of this? And I know this is not a book, but I mean, is there a visceral part of this where Democrats have to figure out a way to engage and excite their base the way the more conservative Republican elements have been able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, their base is different. Their base is poor. Their base is less white. Their base is younger. That's just the nature of the demographic coalitions. And we know historically that those voters tend to be easily disaffected voters who turn out in sporadic ways, whereas older, more affluent, wealthier, white,
right,
religious people turn out at more regular rates. You know, it's not anymore whether you're Catholic or Jewish or
right,
or evangelical that determines who turns out at higher and lower rates. It's not religiosity religious identity. It's religious fealty. It's intensity of religion. It's people who go to church regularly, whatever their denomination, who turn out regularly, and people who are less religious who turn out at lower rates. Again, Democrats tend to be the less religious party. So the Republicans, just by the nature of their coalition, it's more religious, it's older, it's whiter, it's more male, have voting groups that historically, at least, and maybe this will change, and it will have to, I think, change for the Democrats, tend to turn out every 2 years and often in odd year elections, right? Because, you know, five states elect their governors and state legislatures in odd years: Virginia, New Jersey, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Kentucky, right? So there's a structural advantage there, by the way. If you, I don't want to take your you and your listeners too far afield. Most of the governors are elected when? In midterm cycles. Only 11 governors are elected in the presidential cycle.
Which is a down cycle.
Which is, right, for the Democrat. Right. Or up cycle, however you want to look at it.
Right.
Five governors are elected in odd years. Two states, Vermont and New Hampshire, have elected two-year terms, so they're actually elected in both presidential. And but basically, 32 of the governors, two-thirds, right, are elected and for four-year terms in only the midterm cycles. So that benefits the Republicans as well. So they have some structural advantages, and it's not necessarily their fault, but the Democrats have to find a way to get their base mobilized and motivated to vote in, you know, in midterm elections and odd year elections. And so far they don't haven't figured out how to do that. And by the way, it might get harder for them now that Obama, at least for the black voters, is not going to be on the ticket ever again. So their problem may actually get worse, right? Do you hear that, listeners? The Democrats' mobilization problem in non-presidential years may get worse. And that's an unknown. We don't know. It might get better because Hillary Clinton's the nominee and a whole generation of women who, you know, turn out sporadically suddenly turn out and say, hey, hey. So we don't know. I think this is an election like 2008, which I don't want to make a lot of predictions of Hillary Clinton's nominee because it's terra nova, right? There is no precedent here for this.
And who knows what's going to happen in this election? But it's a year away. Many things can happen in politics.
Right.
I keep thinking this is totally not about the book. Since you said that, I was thinking about the Hillary Clinton and winning the nomination. And I keep seeing one vice presidential candidate.
What do you mean? Who? Somebody in particular?
Yes.
Who?
Castro.
Oh, well, you know, there's two theories on this, right? There's two theories on this.
Uh-huh.
One is
Castro being the HUD secretary, former mayor of Santa Antonio.
Right. Well, there's two brothers, of course.
Right, but, one's a congressman.
Right. So there's two theories on this. Again, let's start from the premise that Hillary's the nominee, which I think is a pretty safe premise, right? Does she go for the Latino and now we have a ticket with no white dudes on it, right?
Right.
Or does she have to pick a white dude? I think it's the latter. I think she can't
really.
Pick her. Yep. I'm a person that is strongly supportive and written about the Latino vote.
Yeah.
I'm affiliated with Latino Decisions, which is the number one polling firm, polling Latino attitudes in the country, right? My colleagues, Gary Segura Mapparetto, founded that firm 7 years ago. They're political science colleagues of mine, and I work with them on those projects. And maybe that's just my own cynicism about white America. I'll cop to that. But I think America's ready for things one at a time, a black president, a female president, you know, and maybe a Latino vice president or presidential candidate down the line. But that would be quite the gambit. I mean, I just don't think she can put a woman or a minority on the ticket.
Interesting.
And I'm sorry to say that. I wish that weren't. I wish I didn't think that.
Right.
But if you put the hot lights and start waterboarding me, Mark, I'm going to tell you that. I'm going to tell you that. And maybe that's because of my Whistling Past Dixie experience, because I know, you know, how parts of the country voted, right? You know, in the South, 90% of white voters in some states voted for George W. Bush's reelection. 90% in states like Alabama, Mississippi. States where there's no gender gap among white people. White women vote more Republican than white men, right? It's the only place where there's no gender gap is among white voters, but only in the South. So, you know, I guess I got battle scars from those fights with the last book, and I'm cynical, and it's unfortunate. I wish I thought more of some of my fellow citizens, but I don't. I'll cop to it.
Whoa.
I'm one of those liberal college professors that talk radio likes to scream about, like, doesn't, you know, trust in American public, and I think history's on my side, frankly.
Man, so do you get another book in the works? You're sure you do.
I am working on another book, but it's a national secret, so I can't reveal yet when I have a book contract, I will tell you.
Okay, good. So we've been talking with Tom Schaller, associate professor of political science at UMBC. His first book, Whistling Past Dixie, was great, and this one is as well, The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House. Tom, thanks so much. Good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And on our way to break, we're hearing Baltimore Love Thing by 50 Cent from his album Massacre, which hit number one on this day in 2005. Take one and slide off to the land.